Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Sharing Images, Renaissance Prints into Maiolica and Bronze, the first exhibition of its kind in the United States, brings together some 90 objects to highlight the impact of Renaissance prints on Maiolica and Bronze plaquettes, the two media most dramatically influenced by the technology of image reproduction. Inspired by the acquisition of the important William A. Clark Maiolica, or Glazed Italian Ceramics, collection from the Corcoran Gallery of Art, and drawing largely on the gallery's newly expanded holdings, the exhibition focuses on designs by major artists such as Andrea Mantegna, Antonio de Pollaiuolo, Raphael, Michelangelo, Primogenino, and Albrecht Dürer, telling the story of how printed images were transmitted, transformed, and translated onto ceramics and small bronze reliefs, creating a shared visual canon across artistic media and geographical boundaries. To celebrate the opening of Sharing Images on April 1, 2018, exhibition curator Jamie Gabarelli provides an overview of the exhibition, as well as an introduction to some of its major themes, including the role of prints in the rise of historiato, Maiolica painted with narrative scenes, literally painted with stories, and the rediscovery of ancient art, the manipulation and misunderstanding of visual models, and the artistic exchanges between Italy and Northern Europe in the age of print.
From the center of this ceramic plate, a visibly intoxicated, hoary old man stares back at the viewer. Precariously balanced on a donkey, he is propped up by two nude revelers who march, or rather stagger, in a Bacchic procession against the backdrop of a pagan temple. The disheveled old man is Silenus, the wine-loving companion of Bacchus, surrounded by his customary retinue of exotic animals and muscular drunkards. The prominent coat of arms on the upper left and the emblems on the right suggest that this plate came from the court of Isabella d'Este, Marchioness of Mantua, a highly educated patron and refined art collector. Indeed, a recently rediscovered letter tells us that the plate was part of a service commissioned in Urbino in 1524 by Isabella's daughter, Eleonora Gonzaga, who was the Duchess of that town. In the letter, Eleonora explains that she commissioned the set as a gift for her mother, quote, "Since the maestri of this country of ours have some reputation for good work, and if it pleases your excellency, I shall be happy, and you might make use of it at Porto, since it is a villa thing, una cosa da villa," end quote. The prestigious service, of which 23 pieces are still extant in various museums, and I give you here just a few examples, was painted by Nicola da Urbino, perhaps the finest Maiolica painter of all time. Isabella, who was well versed in classical and biblical literature and an admirer of ancient art, would have certainly recognized the subjects of these plates and may have even identified the sources of the images. While a talented painter, Nicola did not design his own compositions, but rather followed engravings and woodcuts published in Rome and Venice just a few years earlier. In the case of the plate in this exhibition, he freely copied an engraving of the March of Silenus. That print, in turn, was based on an ancient sarcophagus relief of the triumph of Bacchus and Ariadne, and may have been exactly the sort of thing Isabella admired and acquired. Her precious library, inventories tell us, contained, quote, "a variety of printed designs and books of various printed images," end quote. The theme of boozy frolics would have been particularly appropriate for a vessel to be used at country villa feasts. We can easily imagine the wandering gaze of the inebriated diner eating off the plate, meeting Silenus's gaze in an instant of humorous mirroring. But the learned subject and ancient pedigree of the image would also fit the cultured atmosphere of Isabella's rarefied humanist court. Clearly, this plate was not just a dining vessel, but also a marker of cultural status that performed a sophisticated social function. Although made of the same simple materials, earthenware covered with a tin glaze and pigments, this plate, an example of what we called historiato Maiolica, is worlds apart from the sort of ceramics being produced 50 years earlier. Historiato is an Italian word meaning storied or decorated with stories, and is used to describe Maiolica painted with narrative scenes. While always constituting a small elite fraction of Maiolica production, it nonetheless represented a significant aesthetic shift. Not since classical antiquity had ceramics been decorated with narrative pictures. But around 1500, patterns started to give way to fully formed paintings. What happened to bring about such radical change? What the exhibition attempts to show is that the principal catalyst for this artistic revolution was the development of printmaking in the mid-15th century and the resulting proliferation of artistically accomplished images in easily accessible multiples. The technology of print, itself revolutionary, allowed artists to quickly reproduce and spread visual information. Easy to transport and relatively affordable, prints also constituted a rich store of models for other artists to copy, gradually shifting their frames of reference and their artistic practice. A famous illustration in a treatise on the art of pottery, written by Cipriano Picolpasso in the 1550s, shows us istoriato painters working in a busy workshop, surrounded by the designs they could copy onto their plates. The meticulous nature of maiolica painting required a great deal of planning, and compositions would be either traced or copied freehand onto the plate following a model. By the early 1500s, these models, perhaps kept in albums or pinned on the workshop walls, as in Picolpasso's illustration, would have mostly been prints. When maiolica painters started to copy prints onto ceramics, they also began to conceive of their plates as a sort of canvas to tell stories, whence the term istoriato. This shift, in turn, not only elevated the content and cultural ambition of maiolica decoration, but also raised the social aspirations of its makers. As I began to study how maiolica painters used prints as models for their wares, I quickly learned that engravings and book illustrations were also the visual source for a number of bronze plaquettes in the gallery's collection. Plaquettes, small relief sculptures made of bronze or other metals, were produced in the early Renaissance as decorative ornaments, which could either be collected and displayed independently or incorporated into other objects. Like prints, plaquettes could be produced in multiples, albeit in much smaller numbers, and were much in favor with humanist collectors with an interest in ancient art. Once again, the sort of thing Isabella d'Este would, and indeed did, collect. The exploration of these interactions between these media was the impulse behind this exhibition entitled Sharing Images. Admittedly, the three media of print, maiolica, and bronze may seem rather disparate to us today, but in the Renaissance, they not only shared designs, spaces, and owners, but were also perceived to be essentially related. Writing in the mid-16th century, the artist and biographer Giorgio Vasari referred to the ceramics town of Casteldurante, whose potters, quote, excellently crafted earthenware vases, emphasizing in the same sentence that they were, quote, made frequent use of the prints of Raphael and those of other fine artists, end quote. Vasari noted with satisfaction that modern potters had surpassed their Greek and Roman predecessors, for while ancient vases were mostly an opaque red and black, maiolica painting was distinguished for the variety of its bright colors and its gleaming surfaces. Further, in his treatise on mining, metallurgy, and bronze casting, published in 1540, Vannoccio Biringucci devoted a chapter to the art of tin-glazed ceramics, justifying this inclusion by claiming that maiolica and bronze are both arts of fire. Their production depended upon minerals like copper, manganese, tin, lead, transformed by craftsmen through the arte del disegno, and through mysterious, seemingly alchemical processes. If we wanted to push the material reading further, we could point out how engravings, maiolica, and small bronze reliefs all depended on the same resources and international trade infrastructures. For instance, copper, which was usually extracted in Central Europe, was both the material from which printing plates were made and the primary component of bronze. As an oxide, copper also served as the main green pigment for the decoration of Italian ceramics. Tin, mostly mined in and exported from Cornwall, was the key ingredient in the white glaze used for maiolica, as well as the second most common element in bronze. From a historical perspective, prints, istoriato maiolica, and plaquettes, while catering to the growing taste for the antique, were all Renaissance innovations that broke with the past in significant ways. To be sure, the techniques of engraving metal, pottery, and bronze casting had been known since antiquity, but printing on paper, full-color istoriato, and portable bronze reliefs were all novel declensions of these ancient crafts. Most importantly, and here lies the kernel of the exhibition, the three media shared the same images, pictures that constituted a rapidly expanding iconographic canon whose capillary diffusion was made possible by print. The question these works of art both raise and begin to answer is, what happens to an image when it is shared with the world? There are many ways this complex subject can be approached. Its richness and ramifications are indeed what made it so fascinating for me to study. I certainly cannot hope to do it justice here, but in the limited time we have, I would like to take you on a virtual tour of the exhibition's galleries to highlight some of the key themes that connect the objects on display, while pointing out some of the most intriguing results, the unpredictable migration of images from paper to ceramics and bronze. The first gallery in the exhibition considers the impact of prints made in the 15th century, focusing on the rise of istoriato and the interaction between printed images and bronze plaquettes. Istoriato was largely brought about by the contemporaneous development of printmaking on the one hand, and the increased availability of ceramic pigments on the other. The late 15th century was also the heyday of bronze plaquettes, which, while generally a more independent and original medium than ceramics, sometimes followed printed compositions quite closely. In the 14th and early 15th centuries, Italian maiolica covered with an opaque white tin glaze was decorated with the only two colors then available, a copper green and a purplish-brown pigment obtained from manganese. Its most common decorative motifs consisted of simple vegetal or geometric patterns, heraldic or religious symbols, and the occasional human head in profile. The group of objects I am showing you, probably made and unearthed near the Umbrian town of Orvieto, is typical of medieval ceramic production in central Italy, which remained consistent for such a long time that we cannot be sure exactly when or even in which century these wares were made. But throughout the 15th century, aristocratic families and mercantile elites, particularly in Florence, were mostly captivated by the gleaming lustered vessels that were being produced far from home, along the eastern coast of Spain, particularly in Valencia, Malaga, and Manises. Luster, a form of overglazed decoration that produced an iridescent metallic sheen on the surface of the plates, had been developed by Islamic potters in the 9th century, but the complex process of its production was closely guarded as a secret for centuries. As these desirable wares arrived in Italy from Muslim Spain, they spurred the ingenuity and ambition of local potters, for their traditional products simply could not compete in brilliance and technical refinement. The rare and intricately decorated basin that opens the exhibition, probably made in Deruta or Faenza around 1480, was clearly inspired by the complex geometric patterns found on a large chargers from Valencia, with varied or repeating motifs concentrically arranged around a central heraldic symbol. Its novel color palette combines the traditional green with the blue and gold of its Spanish counterpart, but here the Italian potter used a simple orange pigment to stand in for the technically demanding gold luster of his model. The result is undoubtedly a successful fusion of outside influence and local tradition, even though the maiolica painter followed decorative types that had already been popular for decades. At around this time, however, Italian potters in Deruta and Gubbio did succeed in mastering the technique of luster, soon incorporating it seamlessly into narrative paintings, the likes of which had never been seen before in ceramics. While never entirely disappearing, in high-end luxury products, traditional patterns began to share space with, and sometimes entirely give way to, pictures. In the 16th century, patterns also evolved to fit the new taste for classical grotesques. And I can here show you a particularly stunning example from around 1550 at the Getty Museum. But by the early 16th century, istoriato had more in common visually with illusionistic painting on parchment, canvas, or panel than with contemporary ornamental wares, or even the finest Spanish ceramics that preceded them. The tension between these two modes of decoration, the ornamental and the narrative, is already palpable in another rare and large dish made around 1470 or 1480, exhibited in this first gallery. The image of a king seated on a curiously shaped throne in the company of courtiers emerges almost as a tear in the fabric of ornament. Bursting beyond the confines of the central well of the plate, the pictorial field appears to be pushing the patterns to the edges. As you will have guessed, the inspiration for this image was a print, and not just any print, but one of the early masterpieces of Italian engraving. Re, or king, was one from a set of 50 prints made in Ferrara around 1465, depicting muses, virtues, disciplines, planets, gods, and social classes. Technically and aesthetically refined, these prints, sometimes referred to as the Mantegna Tarocchi, were immediately used as models by artists working in a broad range of media. With the earliest known derivations dating to 1467. Our plate was probably produced 5 or 10 years after the appearance of the print. But the series remained a popular model for decades, as witnessed by the fine lustered bowl exhibited next to it, based on the print of the muse Clio and made in Gubbio between 1535 and 1540. The still unknown engraver of the Tarocchi eloquently demonstrated the potential of the new medium. Prints could be sophisticated works of art, purveying erudite content for an elite audience, but could also be produced in large numbers, spreading the influence of their designs wherever they ended up, be it the humanist court or the potter's workshop. Innovative and ambitious artists at the time, most notably Andrea Mantegna and Antonio Pollaiuolo, quickly embraced the new technology as a tool of self-fashioning. A goldsmith, as well as a painter, the Florentine artist Pollaiuolo probably engraved only one print, the unprecedentedly large and ambitious Battle of the Nudes. The engraving, which was prominently signed, was perhaps conceived as a showpiece to demonstrate his skill both as a refined metalworker and as an original designer. Pollaiuolo's designs, however, were also translated into print by other engravers, who spread the influence of his classicizing style throughout Italy and beyond. Cristofano Robetta's Hercules and Antaeus, for instance, depicts one of the labors of Hercules and was based on Pollaiuolo's designs for a painting of the same subject, to which he also gave plastic form in a small bronze statue. It was Robetta's engraving, though, that served as a model for the painter of this early Storiato made in Deruta around 1500 and on loan to us from the Metropolitan Museum. Engravings designed by Andrea Mantegna, court painter to the Gonzaga rulers of Mantua, were even more numerous and influential. Since at least 1475, Mantegna engaged the services of engravers to translate his designs into prints that could be sold or presented as gifts to patrons and admirers. Although Mantegna enjoyed wide renown as an artist during his lifetime, it was through his prints, rather than through the prestigious painting commissions he carried out for his aristocratic patrons, that he became one of the most influential artists of the 15th century, both north and south of the Alps. His engravings, shaped by his profound knowledge of ancient statues, sarcophagus reliefs, inscriptions, coins, and carved gems, in turn were used as models for paintings, reliefs, maiolica, and works in bronze, particularly bronze plaquettes. Mantegna, like Pollaiuolo, repeatedly treated the subject of Hercules and Antaeus. The iconography ultimately derived from a Roman marble sculpture, which Mantegna must have seen in Rome, and which was described by the Mantuan sculptor Antico as, quote, the most beautiful antiquity there is. Multiple engraved versions of Mantegna's drawings of Hercules and Antaeus were produced before 1500, one of them on view in the exhibition, attributed to Giovanni Antonio da Brescia. Giovanni Antonio's engraving was copied shortly thereafter by Marcantonio Raimondi, and it was this version, also on view, that was then copied onto a beautiful lustered bowl painted in 1520 in the workshop of Mastro Giorgio in Gubbio. While the compositions are very similar, a number of details such as the orientation of the club on the ground, Antaeus' raised hand, and the treatment of the hair leave no doubt that Maestro Giorgio's maiolica painter based his work on Marcantonio's version of the subject. Giovanni Antonio's print was also used by maiolica painters, as witnessed by this modeled dish made in Venice around 1540. In the background, the painter even added a typical Venetian landscape. This example gives us a glimpse into the kaleidoscopic proliferation of images made possible by prints. The resulting distortions and variations that occurred in the process of copying are a theme that we will encounter again and again throughout the exhibition. Plaquette makers, for instance, even when they relied on Mantegna's engravings, often modified the compositions to fit their needs. The prolific and refined bronze caster Moderno, working in Verona, followed one of Mantegna's most famous prints, the so-called Entombment with Three Birds, but reshaped its principal elements. He retained the jagged, rocky landscape, the crosses in the upper right, and the four female figures that surround the tomb, but inserted a muscular body of Christ of his own design. Moderno's approach contrasts with that of the talented maiolica painter who transposed Mantegna's design onto a beautiful plaque made in Urbino in 1523, which unfortunately is not part of the exhibition. Here, the painter translated almost the whole composition to the ceramic surface, enlivening it with a balanced palette of cool greens and blues and rich yellows. This exquisite Maiolica plaque, now at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, also provides an indication of the esteem in which 19th century collectors held Maiolica painting. At least if the elaborate gilded frame in which it was displayed is anything to go by. And it is hardly surprising, perhaps, for in the 50 years covered by the works in this gallery, roughly 1470 to 1520, Maiolica painting had transformed from the disciplined application of regular decorative motifs to the ambitious translation in full color of some of the best and most innovative works of Renaissance art. In the Renaissance, innovation went hand in hand with an acute awareness of the art of the past. The concern with classical antiquity, already evident in the first gallery, is explored in greater depth in the second gallery, which considers the influence of Rome of both its ancient and modern treasures in the 16th century. Soon after 1500, Rome became the center of the European printmaking business, and the countless prints and books published in the city spread the knowledge of its artistic monuments throughout Europe. Pictures of its ancient buildings, inscriptions, and statues, many of which were unearthed during the course of the century, extended the influence of Roman art to audiences who had never visited the city. In the age of print, both news and images could travel quickly. The unearthing of the statue of Laocoon from a vineyard in Rome in 1506 sparked a veritable frenzy of interest in the work, which was immediately identified as the one described by the Roman writer Pliny as a masterpiece of ancient art. Immediately after the discovery, letters were written, accounts dispatched, sonnets composed, sketches taken, and of course, prints quickly engraved and published. Perhaps the most famous and authoritative in terms of the state of preservation of the statue around 1506 is this engraving by Marco Dente, a printmaker associated with Raphael's workshop, a beautiful impression of which is on view in this gallery. The print, which shows the statue before the restoration of its right arm, was copied onto Maiolica, for example, on this rather haunting shallow bowl from Urbino, now in Milan, which unusually forsakes the bright hues of Istoriato in favor of monochrome grisaille effect, seemingly to come closer to the imagined marble original. Unfortunately, the Milan plate could not be in the exhibition, but an adjacent group of works is also related to the Laocoon mania. Marco Dente also engraved a second version of Laocoon, which was not based on the recently unearthed marble group, but on an illumination to a 4th century manuscript of Virgil's Aeneid, known today as the Vatican Virgil. This print, depicting the Trojan priest with both arms outstretched and right leg bent under the knee, was used by the great Maiolica painter Francesco Xanto Avelli for a lustered bowl that he signed and dated in 1532, and which is on loan to us from the Metropolitan Museum. In the Metz bowl, Xanto morphs the nude figures of the engraving into armored, bleeding warriors, somewhat puzzlingly placed in an interior. I am thrilled that we were able to bring together the print and the Met plate with a second shallow bowl of the Laocoon from the National Gallery's collection. Made in Gubbio and dated 1539, this later work has been tentatively attributed to Francesco Xanto Avelli. When carefully compared, however, the two plates exhibit substantial stylistic differences. The Met bowl, I'm afraid to say, is of markedly higher quality in design and execution, particularly noticeable in the treatment of the faces and in the internal modeling and shading of the figures. Indeed, I suspect the gallery's plate may be the work of a pupil copying a finished plate by Xanto, rather than a fresh painting based on first-hand knowledge of the print. Xanto did treat the subject of Laocoon a number of times, but it is intriguing that Dente's second version, the one derived from the Vatican Virgil, is the only one that he ever used as a model. Perhaps Xanto thought the depiction of the armless statue less versatile or useful for his purposes, or that it would be unnecessary to have two prints of the same subject, or perhaps, due to the vagaries of the market, Xanto had access to only one of the printed versions. The rest of this second gallery is dedicated to Michelangelo, a towering artistic personality in early 16th century Rome, whose mature style was profoundly indebted to and shaped by classical antiquity. The pairing with Laocoon seemed fitting, for the young Michelangelo was among the first witnesses to set eyes on the marble statue as it was being dug out of the earth in 1506. And throughout his career, he interspersed his works with echoes and quotations from ancient sculpture and sarcophagus reliefs. Rather than documenting his more famous commissions in fresco or marble, the objects displayed in this gallery are connected to the so-called presentation drawings Michelangelo made around 1533 for Tommaso de' Cavalieri, a young Roman nobleman with whom Michelangelo was deeply smitten. While meant as personal gifts for intimate friends, Michelangelo's fame and collector's interest were so great that the highly finished drawings were quickly copied by other draftsmen, carved in rock crystal, cast in bronze plaquettes, and of course published in print. It is these visual echoes, rather than Michelangelo's original sheets, most recently on view at the Metropolitan Museum, that grace a whole wall of the room. The three designs exhibited, the Fall of Phaeton, the Rape of Ganymede, and the Dream of Human Life, are all of mythological or allegorical subject, some of their compositions inspired by ancient models. The Fall of Phaeton, for instance, appears to have been based on a Roman relief, while the strongly homoerotic depiction of Ganymede has much in common with the struggling nude body of Laocoon. The gem carver and bronze caster Giovanni Bernardi was commissioned to engrave in crystal some of these designs even before they were published in print, and probably decided to produce bronze plaquettes of them to capitalize on his access to these coveted drawings. By contrast, the painter of the rare Venetian plate with the Dream, dated 1545, and on loan to us from the Detroit Institute of Art, relied on one of the engravings of Michelangelo's enigmatic design. Depicting a young man being roused by a trumpeting angel and surrounded by confused visions, discarded masks and symbols of gluttony, sloth, lust, and other vices, Michelangelo's composition seems to be a Neoplatonic allegory of the human mind or soul being summoned to a higher spiritual realm. The Maiolica painter faithfully and competently followed his printed source, but his precise subject, no indication of which appeared on the print, remained harder to grasp. Indeed, an inscription on the back of the plate reveals that the Maiolica painter intended to depict the more familiar biblical tale of the dream of Daniel. We cannot tell whether this choice was the result of a deliberate reinterpretation or a simple misunderstanding of the subject of the print, the owner of which probably knew it had something to do with Michelangelo and dreaming. The inscription on the plate, by the way, is the earliest dated interpretation of Michelangelo's dream, but it is still an erroneous one. Unlike their alluring visual form, the exact meaning of the presentation drawings often remained attached to their original private context. By sharing these designs with the world, Prince invited reinterpretation while transforming private gifts into very public images of Michelangelo's art. This kind of unpredictable appropriation, and we should remember that all the objects on view in this gallery were made during Michelangelo's lifetime, was perhaps one of the reasons for the artist's profound skepticism toward Prince. Ever wary of collaboration, Michelangelo never worked with a printmaker to publish his designs, and in general, jealously guarded his own drawings, many of which he destroyed before his death. Only a handful of prints after Michelangelo were published in the first half of the 16th century, a fact that had an arrestingly obvious effect on the contemporary production of Maiolica. Today, roughly a dozen pieces of Istoriato after Michelangelo survive, compared to many hundreds after Raphael. The contrast in attitude towards the technology of print between Michelangelo and Raphael, whose workshop is the linchpin of the next two galleries, could not be greater. Unlike his contemporary Michelangelo, Raphael fully embraced the new medium. Soon after moving to Rome in around 1508, Raphael began to collaborate with the engraver Marcantonio Raimondi, and eventually with a whole team of printmakers, which included Marco Dente, Agostino Veneziano, and probably Jacopo Caraglio. Inspired by the example of Mantegna, Raphael became one of the first Italian artists to personally supervise the production and publication of his designs by closely working with a group of engravers in his workshop. Raphael understood that by taking control of print production, he could increase the workshop's financial returns while spreading his own fame and influence. The plan worked. Prints produced in Raphael's workshop were by far the most influential sources for Italian istoriato in the 16th century. Their appeal is easy to understand. They were plentiful, accessible, and provided examples of Raphael's fashionable classicizing style to artists who had no access to his original works. Raphael's designs are encountered on Renaissance ceramics with such frequency that even in the 16th century, they had become almost synonymous with Maiolica. Remember that Vasari, in the passage I quoted earlier discussing Istoriato, conspicuously mentioned Raphael by name as a source. In later century, this strong association fostered the mistaken belief that the great artist himself had painted on ceramics. The 17th century art historian Carlo Cesare Malvasia, imbued with Bolognese bias, once even disparagingly referred to Raphael as Boccalaio Urbinate, the pot painter from Urbino. As late as the 19th century, major Maiolica collectors still referred to his Storiato as Raphael ware. The truth is that Maiolica painting was a highly specialized craft. Raphael never set brush to plate, and the craze for Raphael designs on ceramics only really begun after the artist's premature death in 1520. The term Raphael here is something of a portmanteau for a whole range of prints produced in and around his workshop. The two central galleries in the exhibition explore, in some detail, different responses to the printed work made in Raphael's orbit or inspired by his example, including pupils and collaborators such as Giulio Romano or Baldassare Peruzzi, as well as followers and admirers such as Parmigianino and Rosso Fiorentino. One of the most fascinating aspects emerging from the exhibition is the variety of approaches to copying and repurposing printed models. Some Maiolica painters faithfully translated entire compositions to the surface of their plates, while others edited, sampled, or reversed prints and combined Raphael designs with those by other artists. The same multiple image available in different workshops could be used in dramatically different ways, reflecting the taste, intentions, and local tradition of the potters. Around 1515, Raphael received a commission to design a set of tapestries showing episodes from the Acts of the Apostles that would decorate the walls of the Sistine Chapel. These monumental cartoons, which are now in the Victoria and Albert Museum, were completed by 1516 and immediately sent to tapestry weavers in Brussels. The cartoons and the Sistine tapestries remained relatively inaccessible, but knowledge of their designs was spread by engravings produced in Raphael's workshop around 1518. One of these, depicting the scene of St. Paul preaching in Athens, was copied onto a beautiful Maiolica plate around 1535, which came to the gallery with the Corcoran collection. While just one of a number of examples of Historiato featuring this design, the gallery's plate is one of the most beautiful and sympathetic translations of this famous print. The identity of the painter, who signed himself with the Greek letters Phi and Delta, remains a bit of a mystery, but it has been suggested that he was a member of the workshop of Guido Durantino, the head of an important dynasty of potters in Urbino, the Fontana, and he may have been responsible for this refined work. In stark contrast to the painstaking transposition of entire printed designs on ceramics is the work of Francesco Xantoavelli, best known for his eclectic cut-and-paste assemblage of single figures and compositional details into creative new holes. Xanto, as he is usually called, was certainly the most original and ambitious Maiolica painter of the 16th century, as revealed by the beautiful calligraphy of the numerous inscriptions on the verses of his plates, as well as a collection of sonnets he composed. Xanto had literary inclinations and courtly aspirations. He was also an extremely talented painter, one who must have been keenly aware of his status, for after 1530, he consistently signed his plates with his full name, a highly unusual practice among pottery painters. Xanto's spectacular charger depicting the Massacre of the Innocents, another Corcoran work, is certainly one of his early masterpieces and occupies a prominent place in the third gallery. The composition of this large plate is an ingenious combination of the two most famous prints of the massacre at the time, Marcantonio's engraving after Raphael and Marcondente's widely admired print after Baccio Bandinelli on the lower right. The tiled floor, the bridge, and the background clearly derive from Raphael at the top right, while many of the figures, as well as the column used as a central axis, are taken from Bandinelli's design. At least two further figures are imported from other prints. There are a number of works by Xanto in these galleries, and I encourage you to seek them out, for they are always very intriguing to look at. A group of objects in the next gallery invites us to consider just how different responses to the same printed images could be. Marco Dente's battle scene was probably designed by Giulio Romano, Raphael's pupil and associate. The animated composition, replete with human and animal bodies in complex dynamic poses, is more likely to be an antiquarian evocation of combat rather than an illustration of a specific subject. The image was very influential, and figures from it reappear with great frequency on Maiolica. The gallery's beautiful flat plate, attributed to the aptly named Painter of the Three Graces, and dated 1525, excerpts only three of the figures and the two horses from the left-hand side of the busy composition, treating them in an ethereal palette of cool greens and blues, accented by areas of gold and ruby luster, typical of the workshop of Maestro Giorgio of Gubbio in which it was made. Next to it, the stunning large dish on loan from the Metropolitan Museum transposes the figures to a different wooded landscape, turning up the chromatic volume in an explosion of oranges, yellows, and dark blue. Highly unusual is the use of black, rarely used on Maiolica, but which adds a remarkable vividness to the image. Two more highlights from this section revolve around the activity of Jacopo Caraglio, an engraver connected to Raphael's workshop, who played a key role in the dissemination of designs by the Mannerist painters Parmigianino and Rosso Fiorentino. Arriving in Rome around 1524, both painters followed Raphael's example and produced a number of designs for publication in print. While Parmigianino was himself an etcher, most of the extant Maiolica after his designs relates to the engravings Caraglio executed, rather than the painter's own etchings. Engravings, such as Caraglio's Adoration of the Shepherds, were printed in larger numbers and were thus perhaps more affordable and readily available than artists' etchings. Caraglio's print, and copies after it, served as a model for a number of istoriati made in Urbino and Faenza. This stunning example from Faenza, characterized by the blue-greenish glaze typical of that city, is on loan to us from the Walters Art Museum. Rosso's designs are represented by a very large charger that usually lives just a few blocks away in the Smithsonian American Art Museum. This glorious work of istoriato is based on Caraglio's engraving of the Muses and the Pierides, an episode in Ovid's Metamorphoses, and appears to have been made in Urbino in the workshop of Orazio Fontana. Other surviving plates and cisterns with the same design suggest that this now relatively rare print was an extremely popular model in the Fontana workshop, which seems to have serialized the production of painted copies, at this stage perhaps made on spec rather than on commission. The fifth and final gallery brings together two important and interconnected themes: the influence of illustrated books on the decorative arts, and the artistic exchanges between Northern and Southern Europe in the 15th and 16th centuries. Commercial ties between Italy, France, Flanders, and Germany were solidly established long before the advent of print, but the new technologies of movable type and image replication intensified and accelerated cultural and artistic exchanges. Books in Latin had from the very beginning been marketed to a learned European audience by means of international book fairs and complex trading networks. The gradual rise of printed books in the vernacular languages increased readership among non-Latin speakers, and some publishers in the 16th century specialized in producing editions of popular works in multiple languages, with a view to selling them to a pan-European market. One of the most prolific and successful was the French publisher Jean de Tournes, who, from 1553, issued numerous illustrated editions of Ovid's Metamorphoses and stories from the Bible. Rather than complete text, these were handy pocket-sized abridgments that combined lively woodcut pictures with a few lines of text summarizing each story. The Italian edition of the Old Testament de Tournes, published in Lyon in 1554, contained 225 woodcuts designed by the French artist Bernard Salomon, undoubtedly a rich yet very affordable repository of models for pottery painters. And indeed, the illustrations from the French editions are among the most frequently used on Maiolica in the later 16th century. Two examples are on view with just at the entrance to the last gallery, next to the booklet open to the biblical episode of Joseph's robe being presented to Jacob. The plate from the Metropolitan Museum was probably painted by Girolamo Tomasi in Urbino around 1560 or 1570, seemingly as a part of a specially commissioned service for the Este family of Ferrara. The gallery's molded dish, on the other hand, whose painter translated the same woodcut in a remarkably different manner, was made somewhat later, perhaps as late as 1600, by an Italian-trained artist working in France. It is not unusual to encounter more than one example of Maiolica based on these little woodcuts, demonstrating their broad and enduring appeal and their widespread circulation. Just like books for the literate public, single sheet prints facilitated the education of and opened up a dialogue between the best artists of the age. For instance, intellectually ambitious masters such as Albrecht Dürer in Nuremberg closely studied the engravings designed by Andrea Mantegna, sometimes inserting quotations from them in his own work. Conversely, many Italian artists were mesmerized by Dürer's unprecedentedly complex and technically unparalleled prints, which were among some of the most copied works of the early Renaissance. It was through the mediation of a copy, rather than a still unknown painter in Gubbio translated Durer's famous prodigal son of circa 1496 to the surface of his plate. Made and lustered in the workshop of Maestro Giorgio in 1525, the plate, on loan to us from the Lehman collection at the Metropolitan Museum, is a masterpiece of early Historiato Maiolica, and something of an icon of Durer's influence in Italy. The opposite orientation of the image implies that the Maiolica painter may not have had access to Durer's original engraving, but only to one of the reverse copies of it produced in Italy shortly after its publication. This was also the case for a different painter working 20 years later in Urbino on a faithful version of The Prodigal Son, which is also in reverse, and now at the Museo Civico in Bologna. Even when mediated through copies, these works attain a high level of artistic accomplishment, while reminding us that Durer's designs remained popular in Italy for decades after they were first published. They also suggest that Durer's prints, exceptional in many ways, were highly collectible from the very beginning and perhaps already too expensive for some pottery painters by the early 1500s. Whether through originals or copies, what we see at work in this last gallery is the rapid shift from local models and artistic traditions to a wider horizon of inspiration. Prints enabled this expansion and were the most powerful driving force in the creation of a shared European visual culture. I'm afraid we have reached the end of our virtual tour, just as one of the many possible tours one could give of this exhibition. But if there is one theme that could unite all of them, is that images, when multiplied and shared, transform the world around them. I hope that by considering the prehistory of the multiple medium of prints, we may gain some insight into not only how images traveled and functioned in the Renaissance, but also into our present and sometimes bewildering image-filled experience. I'm happy to answer questions if there are any. Yes, Peter.
To my understanding, the term historiato was actually a profession.
I think that, well, it wasn't a profession. Well, historiato is a very broad term that applies to anything that's decorated with pictures and stories. So it could be referring to ceramics, but also to illustrated books were called the Biblia Historiata, so figured Bible. I think in ceramics decoration, whoever was producing the narrative paintings were highly specialized craftsmen. And sometimes we see evidence of a plate in which the rim is decorated with patterns in one hand, but then the narrative image at the center of the plate is clearly by a different artist. So I think it was a very highly specialized sort of profession. But
there was no functioning term at the time that referred to
historiatore.
Particular specialty in narrative imagery.
Hmm.
No.
Sorry, if it seemed like I was implying there was no. I've never encountered it. I guess it would be historiatore, but I don't think it appears in documents. It just says painters. Yes.
Do you have any sense of the relative cost of these objects, like a print versus a plate versus a maquette?
Yes. So the prices of prints are very. Not very clear at this time. It's hard to. We have some inventories of workshops, printers' workshops, and sometimes they indicate prices, but it's hard to make hard and fast sort of rules. Maiolica, we have quite a good sense because when they were commissioned, they would often specify the price that they were expecting to pay. It was much, much cheaper than metal plate, which would be the highest end of you know, dining vessels and diningware, much cheaper than, you know, even we have an example of a salt cellar that the Duke of Mantua commissioned in gold, and he paid multiple times the price of a whole set of Maiolica for one salt cellar in gold. So they were not extremely expensive, but they were still, especially Historiato ceramics, luxury goods. Prints, I think, were quite accessible, but again, every print was not the same. Durer prints were probably much more expensive than any Italian print. And plaquettes, I don't know. I really have. They were produced in multiples again, so they you know, I think they were accessible to anyone of sort of modest means and moderate means, yeah. Yes.
So you mentioned this set of plates that was produced for in Urbino at the start.
Mm-hmm.
How common was it to have different images in like a banquet set versus all the same standardized image? And then B, were these commonly used in banquets versus set on display?
Yeah. So usually so big services have different images, and I think the variety was part of the delight in using and interacting with them. The plates were used, and it's stated explicitly in the letter that she was sending them for her to enjoy at a country villa as dining vessels. But that doesn't mean that they were not also important items of decoration when they were not in use. So they could probably be displayed in credenzas. And I think part of the delight was this variety, and the stories depicted sometimes really are quite obscure. So I think there must have been an element of trying to recognize what was on the plate among dinner conversations. And sometimes they have a legend at the back, an inscription that identifies the subject, and sometimes even the literary source of that story. So they were for a literate a literate and sophisticated public. Mary.
Are there any known connections between a collector who would have requested a set of Maiolica and their collection of prints? Would they, i.e., have provided some of these prints possibly to the Maiolica?
I suspect that might have been the case. I would love to have evidence of that. But the contracts I encountered and read that were commissioning services often don't even specify what kind of subjects they want. They just want beautiful pictures that are appropriate for the context, you know. And so they're very generic in their language. I found a fascinating and tantalizing example of a set commissioned by a set that bears the arms of a French nobleman, Anne de Montmorency, and he was sort of a constable of France, an extremely important personage, and one of Rosso Fiorentino's patrons in France. So he owned paintings by Rosso Fiorentino. And a number of the plates in his service, or the service with his arms, have images by Rosso Fiorentino that were published in print. I don't know whether that's a coincidence. It's a bit of, you know, he might have specified, it's like, put some images by Rosso because I like them, but I don't know. Yeah, it's very tantalizing, but there's no proof. Yes, at the back.
Are there any noticeable differences that you have discovered between services commissioned for secular courts and services commissioned by clergy and perhaps cloister?
Mm-hmm. So we have some examples of cardinals, for example, commissioning sets, and they don't really say it has to be all religious. They just say we want decorations with stories that are appropriate, but they don't specify religious necessarily. In fact, in religious subjects in general are quite rare in historiato in the first half of the 16th century. They become, with the Counter-Reformation, much more common in the second half of the 16th century. Even on Isabella d'Este's service, there are biblical scenes, there are mythological scenes, the scenes from ancient history. I think there was a variety, and even cardinals in Rome would have been very interested in classical mythology anyway. So later on, after the Counter-Reformation sets in, we have examples of services commissioned by monasteries that only have religious images on them. So I think it becomes more important later on than earlier. Yes.
How did the mirror image reversal of the images? I think there were two plates you showed. It's as if the painter was copying the plate rather than the.
Oh yeah, yes, the Xanto. You mean how? Why do I think that?
Well, I mean, how? What exactly was? How did it get reversed? He didn't do it. I assume he was copying, but I don't know.
Yes, okay, so there are two possibilities. The painter might have decided to flip the image because he preferred it in a different orientation. So in that sense, you could trace a print, flip the sheet, and transfer it onto the plate. Or, which I think is more likely because it happens often with Dura images that they are reversed, they probably had access to a printed copy, which was already in opposite orientation. And this happens a lot when prints are copied, that it's quite hard to retain the same orientation. So it's easier to just copy it, and then in the process of copying it, the image is flipped.
Somebody had re-engraved the image.
Exactly. And it flipped it, and then it was just easier to retain that. But it happens that even when there are no reversed copies, painters would flip the figures around. Yeah.
See. Once the Maiolica products have been produced, they become private property, so they are out of circulation, so to speak, in a closed context. So would you empower even more the Maiolica workshops being the gatekeepers of these images? Because it's not like one painter would see another Maiolica plate and copy it, so mm-hmm. it's not.
Yeah.
Could you say a few more things about the importance of the Maiolica workshops in controlling this?
Yeah. No, I love the idea of let me think. I think it's true. Other Maiolica painters would not necessarily see works produced in different cities or different, but in the context of the workshop, they might see examples painted by earlier artists that were still in the workshop and used as models. And I like that the idea of Maiolica sort of preserving the images, because sometimes prints were lost, and especially 15th century prints have a very low rate of survival comparatively. So in some cases we have plates that are based clearly on, clearly, they suggest strongly that they were based on a printed design, and the original of which is lost. So they are, in fact, the only testimony to that design that remains. So yeah, I know it is a nice idea that they are, secured away in people's cupboards, and they're less, they're less likely to perish from mold or fire or something like that. Yes.
I know that Garuta, of course, is still very ceramic production, but I wondered about the other centers that you've mentioned,
Mm-hmm.
Udo and Faenza.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're still actively producing ceramics.
They are, yeah. Garuta is very active, as you say, and Faenza is probably the second most. There's a lot of contemporary ceramicists working there, and still a lot of industry. Yeah. Yes.
I assume that Maiolica came to an end at some point.
Well, it's still going strong. I guess the people are still making Maiolica, but it's the taste, I think, shifted at the end of the 16th century from this kind of wares that were completely covered in images to a more mixed approach. In the 17th century, patterns start coming into the rims as well, and the designs that are copied also shift with the taste, so they start being based on Carracci rather than Raphael. And then I think later on, porcelain just became more important, because when Europeans figured out how to make porcelain, that became more, more desirable, and the sort of artistic ambition of the medium as a whole probably waned after that. There was one question at the back. Yeah, he's been.
Hi, I was curious about use and display. So, first of all, would they have actually been used to serve food on? And then, assuming that is the case, would they have ever been displayed in the period in the residences?
Yeah. Well, I think yes, that all of these things were made to be used, because again, they were expensive, but not ridiculously expensive. And indeed, we have written evidence that a visitor to the court of Clement VII, for example, was surprised that the Pope was not eating off Istoriata Maiolica, but rather using just simple plain white plates. And he said, he wrote back home to Urbino saying, we should send him a set because he's not using Istoriato to eat. And it's, so, clearly it was it was used. And whether it was displayed, it's hard because it lends itself to being displayed. And some plates, especially the large chargers, have holes fired in the back so that would allow them to be hung from a wall. But so yeah, they would be displayed. We don't have any visual evidence of that, which is annoying because we have lots of visual evidence of people with their beautiful silver and gold plate displayed nicely on, in the dining rooms. But there's no visual evidence of Majolica being displayed like that. So we just assume that it was because of physical and material evidence, but we don't have other. Yes?
Were these only commissioned objects, or were there stores that sold sets?
That's interesting. I think Historiato, especially in the first half of the 16th century, when they were like plates like these that were fully painted, were probably always commissioned. I think later on they started to make them because they were popular and they started, you know, they would sell. But we should remember that plates like this that have paintings and stories on them were really, really the top fraction of an enormous, almost industrial production of ceramics at this time. So you could just go to a potter's shop and they would have all sorts of things. And you could even ask them just to put your coat of arms and just keep it very simple. And so I think there were various levels and a whole range of prices and quality and purpose. Well, if there are no other questions, I hope you enjoy the show, which is open in the West Building.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.